So you may have noticed then on the notices for today that the specific title I've given this evening's sermon is Are Christians Environmentalists? It seems to me it's a relevant question for us to ask for at least two reasons. Reason number one, environmentalism is clearly a huge phenomenon in our day. You can't miss it, whether you're reading the election manifestos of our political parties or buying loose fruit and veg at Sainsbury's or reading the signs about what to do with your used towels in your Travelodge bathroom. You're made aware of environmentalist issues. It's everywhere. And then reason number two, environmentalism clearly produces different responses within the evangelical church. So you go into some church buildings and look at the notice boards and you won't see any information about missionaries taking the gospel to the nations of the world, but there'll be loads of stuff about reducing your carbon footprint. Environmentalism has been embraced in a very big way by those churches, but then you go into other churches and you'll hear the preacher perhaps in his sermon scoffing at environmentalism and placing it in basically the same category as gay pride and that kind of thing, just another wholly pernicious modern movement. And so I'm saying that for these two reasons, the fact that environmentalism is huge and the fact that there's such a range of Christian responses, it's relevant to ask this question, are Christians environmentalists? And I'm actually going to give you my answer straight away. It takes the form of one rather wordy sentence, which I'll then spend the rest of our sermon unpacking for you. So here it is. Here's my answer. Christians should have environmentalist instincts which submit to the biblical storyline and recognize biblical imperatives. I'll say that again. Christians should have environmentalist instincts which submit to the biblical storyline and recognize biblical imperatives. So let's unpack that by breaking it down into its three constituent parts. So first of all, then, Christians should have environmentalist instincts. It seems to me that there can be a strange inconsistency within our conservative evangelical circles, which goes like this. We have a high view of creation as an act, as an event, so that we are passionate about dismantling evolutionary theory and defending a literal reading of Genesis 1. We have a high view of creation as an act, as an event, but at the same time, we don't have a very high view of creation as an actual thing, as an entity, the creation. A couple of years ago, I did a jigsaw puzzle. Now you might think, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, the big deal about that is that I don't normally do jigsaw puzzles. If I'm given a jigsaw puzzle, it normally remains on a shelf unopened. But on this occasion, I was given one and I did it. And I look back and I don't really know why I did it. It was just kind of this random, uncharacteristic action. And I have a feeling that we often think of God creating the universe a little bit like that. We're convinced that he did it, and we will argue vigorously and passionately that he did it. But we have this lurking sense that it was a rather random and uncharacteristic thing for him to do, because after all, God is into souls and spiritual stuff, not mountains and rivers and soils and squirrels. But when we think like that, we are wrong. We're wrong. We have a big box of Lego that sometimes we get out and the children play with it. And when they do so and they make things from the Lego, they don't make things that have nothing to do with who they are. So Fraser doesn't start building a laundrette or an old people's home or something with the Lego blocks. No, he'll build a fortress or a futuristic vehicle of some kind because such things appeal to him. And in the same way, then, God makes mountains and rivers and soil and squirrels because such things appeal to him. That's the significance, surely, the most basic significance of that recurring phrase in Genesis 1. He saw that it was good. We tend to read that in the light of Genesis chapter 3, don't we? And we think that what that's saying is that it was at this point still unmarred by sin. But that's not the natural way of reading that phrase. A few years ago, we went to see the Railway Children performed at Newcastle Theatre. And so if you'd asked me afterwards what was it like, I might have said, oh, it was good. It was good. Now, I'm not there making a moral evaluation. I'm not saying, well, there was no sex and nudity and bad language in it. Of course there wasn't. It was the Railway Children. I'm saying that we enjoyed it. It brought a smile to our faces. And that's what that refrain is saying in Genesis 1, most basically. Not that it was good morally. Of course it was good morally. But it was good. It brought enjoyment. It brought pleasure. It brought a smile to the face of God as he looked upon what he had made. And God's enjoyment then of his creation is confirmed in Psalm 104. You remember how that psalm is about God's sustaining of the creation. But you can't miss the relish with which he sustains his creation. It's not this tedious chore for him to provide food and drink for all his creatures. Rather, he does it as something that he loves doing, and you get the climax of that in verse 31 as the psalm is drawing to a close, and the psalmist says, may the glory of the Lord endure forever, may the Lord rejoice in his works. And the psalmist isn't saying, may the Lord start to rejoice in his works because he's not rejoicing in them at the minute. The point is, may the Lord continue to rejoice in his works, to enjoy this creation that he so enjoys. And once then we see creation from this perspective, not as some random project in which God once engaged and we can't really explain why, but rather when we see creation as a source of joy to God, then two things follow very naturally. Number one, it's very natural to make it a source of our joy too. God is our Heavenly Father, after all. I mean, children often get into the things that their parents are into, don't they? I don't think that before she met me, Hannah had ever been to a football match, and that's because then her parents aren't into football. But our Father then, our Heavenly Father, derives great joy from the creation, and it's natural for us as his children to derive great joy from the creation. Hence you have texts like Psalm 111 verse 2. Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who delight in them. Our Father delights in them, and so we as his children delight in them. Enjoying creation is a good thing. We shouldn't be embarrassed about it. Spurgeon said, do not look with scorn upon any of the things that are around you. That lovely river, those fertile valleys, that dense forest, yonder snow-clad Alps, and everything else that Christ hath created. You need not say, as some have done, I will not gaze upon the beauties of nature, lest they should take my thoughts away from my master. He's criticizing a kind of hyper-spiritual attitude that, oh no, we don't enjoy creation, we enjoy God. No, Spurgeon says, we enjoy the creation that God himself enjoys. So it's natural then to make it a source of our joy too. And then the second thing that follows, it's very natural to be concerned with the conservation of that which is certainly a source of joy to God and is probably a source of joy to us as his children. It's odd, I mean, to be indifferent to the disappearance of rainforests that God enjoys and that we as his children enjoy. It's odd to be indifferent to the disappearance of polar bears that God enjoys and that we as his children enjoy. It's odd to be indifferent to the filling of the seas which God enjoys with plastic. There's something jarring about singing in Psalm 104, may the Lord rejoice in his works, and then being unconcerned about those works disappearing or being badly disfigured at least. So, as Christians then, I'm saying we should be concerned for the conservation of a natural world that is such a source of joy to God. Indeed, a natural world that reveals his glory. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. I mean, there's one form of pollution, at least, isn't there, that unquestionably interferes with that. Light pollution. And I know that street lights are good things and all the rest of it, but surely we don't relish the thought of such an urban sprawl creeping over our land that few people ever get a glimpse of that which so wonderfully declares the glory of God. Surely that should arouse environmentalist instincts in even the most cynical of us. And so I'm saying then that Christians should have environmentalist instincts as those who are the children of a God who enjoys the creation, the children of a God who is glorified in the creation. And let me just take this one step further before I move on. It seems to me actually that we should see damaging the natural world as a logical expression of man's rebellion against God. It's an interesting feature of Babylon in the Old Testament that it had no respect for the natural world. Babylon, of course, as you know, was this notoriously idolatrous and arrogant empire opposed to the living and true God. But there was also this feature that comes across in several texts that the Babylonian empire had no respect for the natural world. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 17, this is the prophet kind of looking forward to when Babylon will have been brought down. And this is what Habakkuk says: the violence done to Lebanon. What do we know about Lebanon? The wonderful trees. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. Isaiah 14, verse 8, you get a similar note struck. The cypresses rejoice at you, Babylon, having been brought down. The cedars of Lebanon saying, since you were laid low, no woodcutter comes up against us. The Babylonians have just gone around chopping down the cedars of Lebanon. And now that Babylon has been brought down, the prophet depicts the cedars themselves rejoicing because they have peace. You have a similar phenomenon in Psalm 73. In verse 9, where we read of the wicked, that they set their mouths against the heavens and their tongue struts through the earth. Derek Kidner says, talks about their vanity egging them on to hector the very universe. And so Christians then should have environmentalist instincts, wanting the conservation of that which is a source of joy to God and indeed reveals his glory, seeing environmental recklessness as a logical expression of man's rebellion against God. Now, the next two parts of my proposition tonight will qualify that in important ways, but they won't override that. And I don't want us to forget this first point then tonight. Modern environmentalism may be a godless, politically correct movement that you and I would never touch with a barge pole, but that doesn't mean that we react childishly by making our lifestyles as environmentally unfriendly as we possibly can. No, Christians should have environmentalist instincts. But then, secondly, this evening, Christians should have environmentalist instincts which submit to the biblical storyline. Christians should have environmentalist instincts which submit to the biblical storyline. Because it seems to me then that the biblical storyline, while not, as I said just now, overriding those environmentalist instincts that are right and proper, it does curb them. It does qualify them. Let me put it this way. In terms of our attitude to the environment, the biblical storyline calls for three things, three R's. First of all, it calls for realism. It calls for realism. So, of course, one massively key moment in the biblical storyline is man's fall and the curse which God imposed on his creation as a consequence of the fall. And we read, don't we, the implications of the curse in Genesis chapter 3. And obviously they're unpleasant as they come across there in Genesis chapter 3. But Genesis 3 is a very kind of man-centered account of the curse, isn't it? It mainly focuses on what the curse means for man's food production. Three times there's a reference to eating. Cursed is the ground because of you. This is Genesis 3:17. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Verse 18, thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. Verse 19, by the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. So these three references to eating. So you get a sense of how Adam in his daily life is going to be affected by the curse, but you don't get a sense in Genesis 3 of the broader cosmic implications of the curse. But you do later in the Old Testament. And twice, in fact, there's an interesting analogy that the Old Testament uses. It compares the creation now, in its cursed form, to a garment that is wearing out. Psalm 102:25, of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain. They will all wear out like a garment. And then Isaiah 51:6, lift up your eyes to the heavens and look at the earth beneath, for the heavens vanish like smoke. The earth will wear out like a garment. And then in the New Testament, in Paul's writings, you have similar comments. 1 Corinthians 7:31, the present form of this world is passing away. Romans 8:21, of course, the creation is in bondage to decay. So, clearly then from those texts, the effect of the curse is not merely isolated symptoms like thorns and thistles, or on a bigger scale, earthquakes, droughts, volcanoes, and so on. Now, the effect of the curse is more pervasive than just isolated symptoms. The whole thing, the whole creation, is wearing out. That's what those texts are saying. There's a process of degeneration at work. And yes, human beings can do further damage on top of that process of degeneration, and we shouldn't condone that. That's the point. It's at that point that those environmentalist instincts I've talked about should kick in. But however environmentally friendly we might be, that process of degeneration isn't going to go away. That's what I'm saying. It's inevitable and it's irreversible, and we need to be realistic. Therefore, I've commented before on those posters that you get at bus shelters and so on, advertising cancer research, which say things like, you know, cancer, we're coming to get you. And it's just so arrogant and deluded, isn't it? This idea that, you know, through our human brilliance, we're going to eliminate all diseases. We're not, because we can't overcome the curse. And it's similar then in the realm of environmentalism, isn't it? You get these ridiculous slogans about saving the planet. It's nonsense. We're not going to save the planet. We can minimize pollution. We can help the planet. And as I said, these environmentalist instincts within us are right and proper. But the whole thing is wearing out like a garment at the end of the day. It's passing away. It's in bondage to decay. We can't overcome the curse. So the biblical storyline, first of all, it calls for realism. Then secondly, it calls for reliance. It calls for reliance. Think of another moment in the biblical storyline. Not as high profile as the curse. The covenant with Noah. Genesis 8 and 9. That promise, remember, that you have at the end of Genesis 8. It was in our hymn just now. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. Now I suppose that throughout much of history, that promise has seemed fairly bland and unremarkable. it wouldn't have seemed bland and unremarkable to Noah, would it? He had just witnessed the dissolution of all those things that God promises there in Genesis 8:22. He had just witnessed a comprehensive environmental disaster, the natural world reduced to a state of total chaos and uninhabitableness. That promise would have been massively relevant to him. And he would have had to rely on it, especially when he saw clouds gathering in the sky. And he saw and he felt rain begin to fall. And immediately his mind went back to the flood. He would have had to rely, wouldn't he, on that promise? No, it's not going to happen again. These elements around me aren't going to be dissolved again. But the world is now going to be structured and rhythmic. He'd have had to rely on that promise. And I suppose now then we find ourselves living in a time when again the promise is massively relevant. I mean, I spoke just now about the ridiculously optimistic language that is used about saving the planet. But of course, there's some very pessimistic language that gets used today as well, isn't there? About how if we continue on this present trajectory, the planet's going to become uninhabitable. Extinction Rebellion is the name of the group protesting in our cities recently. So that title then, floating this prospect of us becoming extinct if we continue on our present trajectory. And in the face of that kind of highly charged rhetoric then, like Noah, we need to rely on that promise, don't we? And it doesn't mean that human beings can't cause significant damage to the creation. And it doesn't mean that we should be unconcerned about that and complicit in that. But it does mean we should reject the wilder predictions that we hear and not give in to panic. It's interesting, isn't it, that the very next verse, Genesis 9, verse 1, we read, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. You had, was it last summer, Prince Harry, I think, announcing that he and his wife aren't going to have more than two children because of the environment. And let me just quote to you the words of one Christian writer who says at that very point, that is at this point when God has promised that these things will continue, at that very point, God also says to man, be fruitful and multiply. It was a challenge to Noah's faith. We have, of course, no right to use our sexuality irrationally because we are not beasts, and no man should bring into the world more children than he and his wife can care and provide for. But any birth control which is a reflection of unfaith, of a lack of confidence in the sovereign provider, is illegitimate for a Christian. We cannot refuse to have families simply because of ecological fears. That is what this covenant is arguing against. It is coming right into Noah's existential situation, into his fear. It also comes into our 21st century fears, our fear of world war, of overpopulation, of nuclear horror, of ecological disaster. It says to us, be fruitful and multiply. And our glad compliance is an expression of our faith in God and of our confidence in the future of the earth. Not for a moment does this discharge us from our environmental responsibility. We must use our environment rationally as we use our sexuality rationally. But clearly, one of the great stipulations of God's covenant is that we should not fearfully refuse to procreate. So the biblical storyline, it calls for realism, it calls for reliance, and then thirdly, it calls for a relocation. It calls for a relocation. So I've said then that as Christians we don't fall into these delusions of saving the planet and healing the environment. We are realistic because the biblical storyline involves a curse. A process of degeneration is inexorable. Now I want to add this, that in actual fact the biblical storyline does involve the planet being saved and the environment being healed. It does, but not through human effort and not within history. Within history, the curse will continue to prevail and the creation continue to wear out. But when the end of history comes, with the return of Jesus Christ, according to the biblical storyline, creation is not then going to be discarded, it's going to be renewed. 1 Corinthians 7:31, I quoted earlier, the world in its present form is passing away. Romans 8:21, the creation is going to be liberated from its bondage to decay. And this then is all intelligible, isn't it? Within the Adam-Christ parallel that we have in Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15. The first Adam disobeyed God by eating that forbidden fruit, and that failure caused the ruin of the whole creation. But in stunning grace, God sends a new Adam, Christ. He obeys God ultimately by laying down his life on Calvary. And his success causes the restoration of the whole creation. The difference this time is that there's a time lag. The ruin immediately followed Adam's disobedience. The restoration didn't immediately follow Jesus' obedience. It awaits the second coming, but it will happen. And it means then that we don't simply deny and refute the environmentalist vision of a healed universe functioning flawlessly and in perfect harmony. Rather, we relocate that vision to the age to come. It will become a wonderful reality then as a consequence of the redeeming work of Jesus Christ, the last Adam. It seems to me that this point then is not sufficiently recognized by those in the church who push very forcefully an environmentalist agenda. I mean, those who go further than I went in the first part of this sermon tonight and say it's not just about environmentalist instincts, rather we have a specific divine mandate as the church in relation to the environment. And they will go then to Genesis 1:28, where, as you know, man was appointed as creation's king to exercise dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Which of course doesn't mean a tyrannical, exploitative dominion, but a responsible dominion that enables creation to flourish. And indeed, man's possession of that dominion is confirmed, they will say, in Psalm 8. And exercising that dominion then that we've been given in Genesis 1 and that is confirmed in Psalm 8, it means being highly proactive when it comes to the welfare of the natural world. And here's an interesting question then that I think it's worth pondering. What should we make of man's rule over the creation? Man's rule over the creation now, I mean, in a post-fall world. Well, I don't think I quite have biblical warrant to say that man's rule over the creation was revoked at the fall. I'd be hesitant about using language as strong as that. But I would say this: the Bible doesn't seem to treat that reign as meaningful in a post-fall world. Rather, it relocates the whole concept to the age to come. A key passage here is Hebrews 2:5-9. That I read to you earlier on, and remember how there the writer quotes Psalm 8. But he doesn't quote Psalm 8 as a celebration of man's present reign over the creation. He doesn't even quote it as a wistful recollection of man's pre-fall reign. No, he quotes it rather as a prophecy of the future. He says in verse 5, it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come. So he's talking about the world to come here, and in that connection he uses as his supporting text Psalm 8. And he quotes from Psalm 8, and then he continues, at present we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. In other words, he treats the psalm as a future prophecy that hasn't yet been fulfilled. So I don't think we should build an elaborate environmentalist agenda on the concept of Adam and his seed ruling over creation. I think that fails to take into account the biblical storyline. In the biblical storyline, that concept has been relocated to the age to come, where the new Adam and his seed, his blood-bought seed, rule over the new creation. My favourite hymn is an old Welsh one that's been translated into English. In Eden, sad, indeed that day, my countless blessings fled away, my crown fell in disgrace. So I ceased to exercise kingship with Adam. My crown fell in disgrace that day. But then it continues, but on victorious Calvary, that crown was won again for me. My life shall all be praise. It's with Christ I shall one day exercise kingship again. As Revelation 5:10 puts it, you have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth. We shall reign then on the earth. So I'm saying then the biblical storyline curbs our environmentalist instincts, which are right and proper and should be there. It curbs them in these three ways. It calls for realism. The curse means creation is going to keep on wearing out. It calls for reliance. The promises to Noah mean that we don't need to fear some kind of total environmental meltdown. It calls for relocation. The coming rejuvenation of the cosmos means we transfer the notion of a perfect, healthy environment from this age to the age to come, when Jesus and all redeemed humanity will exercise the most loving, responsible dominion over it. So Christians should have environmentalist instincts which submit to the biblical storyline, and then finally, and recognize biblical imperatives, and recognize biblical imperatives. The Bible contains lots of imperatives, lots of commands. And the Bible's imperatives, I think it's fair to say, at least those that are permanently binding, not just binding on Old Testament Israel, don't regulate man's treatment of the environment. Now again, that doesn't override those environmentalist instincts that we should have, but it does need to be recognized. It means then that at the church level, we have no right to make conservation of the environment part of our mission statement. Preaching the gospel, yes. Administering the sacraments, yes. Exercising pastoral discipline, yes. Worshipping Jesus Christ, yes. All on the basis of clear biblical imperatives. Conserving the environment, no. We don't have those clear biblical imperatives in the same way. It doesn't mean then that an evangelical church won't decide at its members' meeting that it's going to stop using plastic cups or install solar panels for its energy or whatever. That is fine. An expression perhaps of environmentalist instincts. But an evangelical church can't credibly say one of the reasons we exist as a church is to do our bit for the environment. And then at the individual level, it means we need to be careful. I mean, one of the great treasures, I would say, of our Reformed heritage is the doctrine of Christian liberty. You read John Calvin's Institutes and a magnificent chapter, massive, magnificent chapter, on Christian liberty. The Westminster Confession of Faith: God alone is Lord of the conscience. So you and I cannot bind another person's conscience. Only God can bind a person's conscience, and God only does that here in the Scriptures. It's a great treasure of our Reformed heritage, the doctrine of Christian liberty. I don't have the right to say to someone, you must do this, and if you don't do this, you're sinning, if God in the Bible hasn't said that. I mustn't invent new sins for people. And it applies in this area then. Is buying single-use plastics sin? No. Is driving somewhere when you could walk sin? No. Is using disposable nappies sin? No. For all our environmentalist instincts, we mustn't infringe the liberty of brothers and sisters in Christ in this area. Saying things like, your lifestyle is wrong, it's displeasing to God because of this environmentally unfriendly aspect and this one, that's illegitimate. We can only say things are wrong, displeasing to God, where we have solid biblical grounds for doing so. So recognizing biblical imperatives is really important. However, I just want to close by qualifying that point in this way. It seems to me that there is a genuine category of behavior which cannot be condemned because it doesn't violate biblical imperatives, but which can be viewed as inconsistent with our biblical worldview. There was an article in Evangelical Times a few months ago by Stephen Rees on gambling, and he basically used this argument there. And he said then, if someone comes to me and says, is it wrong for me to gamble? I can't say, yes, it's wrong for you to gamble, because God hasn't said that in his word. But, he said in the article, I would go on to discourage that person from gambling for this reason, and this reason, and this reason, because of biblical worldview arguments. For those reasons, I would discourage that person. So I think it is an area of behavior. There is a category of behavior that, no, we can't condemn as wrong because God hasn't, but that we can say is inconsistent with a biblical worldview, I suppose, might apply to some activities that are done on the Lord's Day. And we can't say that those things are wrong, but we might say, well, is that really consistent with what we say is the significance of the Lord's Day? And if then I find myself utterly unconcerned about the environment, never thinking in any other terms than as a consumer, for whom convenience and ease and cutting costs are all important, perhaps I should ask myself the question, hang on a minute. Is that really consistent with my singing here on a Sunday, Psalm 104, may the Lord rejoice in his works? Is it really consistent of me to say that, may God rejoice in his creation, and then for me to be living a lifestyle which is indifferent to the interests of, the welfare of that creation? And equally, if my Christian brother or sister is leading a lifestyle that is utterly unconcerned about the environment, and again, is just purely being lived in consumerist terms, then perhaps I might say to my brother or sister, hang on a minute, is that fully consistent with what you were singing in church last Sunday when we sang Psalm 104? Is it fully consistent with what you profess to believe about the creation? That God made it and God enjoys it and God is glorified in its every molecule. Is it really consistent with that for you to be living a lifestyle that is so indifferent to the creation? And so I leave those thoughts with you. There's much more that can be said, but Christians should have environmentalist instincts which submit to the biblical storyline and recognize biblical imperatives. Amen.